demographic changes are transforming the American landscape to become a majority minority country. And this has created all types of cultural and political tensions in our society. What do we do? How can Americans who believe in a just and fair America create a nation that embraces and welcomes all of us?
Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
Today, I talked to Oregon District Attorney John Harrelson Suarez about justice, and he shares some interesting insights on what he sees as the critical pieces of justice. Enjoy our conversation. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast and give us a rating. Of course, see the show notes for more information about Attorney Harrelson Suarez. Hi, Attorney Harrelson. Welcome to the Empowerment Zone.
Hello, Dr. Houston. Thank you for inviting me to have a conversation with you today.
Man, I was so happy that you accepted my invitation. I really value your work that you do professionally and the work that you do in terms of inspiring young people and really assisting with the development, the growth and development of the United States Hispanic Leadership Institute. So I'm very happy to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. And also, I appreciate the incredible role you've played in promoting leadership through education. You've had a presence with USHLI that is historic. And I think that that's something that you bring to many, many different platforms. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Attorney Harrelson. So if you will, can you give me a little bit about your background? I'm really interested in learning, how did you get into being a district attorney? What is your educational, professional development? What is your background in terms of your family? Because I'm sure your family had an influence on your growth and development as well.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I'm perhaps most recognizable as the Benton County District Attorney. That's the 21st Judicial District in the state of Oregon. Also recognizable as the board chair for the United States Hispanic Leadership Institute. But notwithstanding those titles, as a person, I am a person who was blessed with parents who exposed me to two different cultures. I was raised in what I would describe as an old school Latino household with all the traditions that go with that. But I lived in my youth in Mexico, in Monterrey, Nuevo León, and in the U.S. as well. And so having that opportunity to grow up as a native Spanish speaker, immersed in a traditional culture, but also raised in the United States and learning the dominant culture as well, enriched my own experience. Now, with regards to my family, I'm the first in my family to ever go to law school, and I never knew a lawyer until I went to law school. Those are not the circles that our family was engaged with. But I do know that at a very young age, I became very, very focused on what was fair and what wasn't. Maybe that's because I was the youngest child in a large family. And when you're the youngest, you know, you're trying to battle for your spot. And, you know, you say, no es justo, it's not fair. And so that's a big piece of it. You know, one other thing I'll throw out is kind of to jump back. I thought to myself, you know, my name is John Harrelson, but I was raised John Harrelson Suarez Rodriguez Gutierrez Ballesteros de Lara, and literally just raised to know, what is your lineage? Where did you grow up? And to know about your people and to know where you came from. And so it's hard for me to ever talk about an introduction without including all of those generations that lifted me up.
So you talked about growing up the youngest child and your parents being an influence on you. How did you get into studying law? Like, what was your pathway? Why did you choose to go to law school?
Well, that's an interesting story because, you know, I'm not the person who at a young age said, I'm going to be a lawyer one day. In fact, to be honest, if I would have said something like that, I wouldn't have known what I was talking about. What I do remember is that, you know, my mother, who was raised in, you know, a serious degree of poverty, really was a survivor. And she would say to my brothers and I, which is kind of a cliche from that era, you know, of the early 1900s, that we should, que debemos ser abogados, sacerdotes, o doctores. We should be doctors, lawyers, or priests. And so when I went to school, to play basketball. And I wasn't really thinking about what I was going to study. And it just so happened that I liked philosophy. And so I loved philosophy. And from there, I was getting close to graduating. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? Nobody's going to pay me to sit on a hill and think. So I decided, well, I'm going to follow my mother's advice and I'm going to go to law school. So there I went. And I was discovering it every step that I took. And as I was working as an intern, as a city prosecutor, I had an opportunity to try cases that really gave me a sense of the importance of advocating for justice, not to get convictions, but to pursue justice through the truth. And I was hooked.
Wow, what an interesting story about how your family guided you into that career without you really knowing what that career was about. So I'm sure that once you started attending grad school, who were your mentors? Who did you look up to? Were there any Latino lawyers that you aspired to be like? Or was this, like you said, you learned every step of the way? What was your process to be able to see yourself in that role, in other words?
Sure. Well, I did not have any mentors, at least not that I was directly engaged with. I did have some mentors from afar. Recently retired Judge Angel Lopez was one of those few attorneys that I was aware of at the time that I was going to law school, Latino, that was practicing law in the state of Oregon. And so there was an inspiration there that connected with Danny Santos as well, was also a key figure in that sort of awakening as I was going through the process. But one of the benefits of, you know, looking at the silver lining is that because I didn't have a mentor at that time, it did allow me to better appreciate what I wish I had in retrospect. And that's a big driver for why I devote time and energy and my heart into offering that mentorship and supporting systems that offer mentorship to students.
Because you want to provide what you didn't have.
Exactly, yes.
And that's so important in terms of giving back, is you have to, you know how much of a difference it may have had in your life had you had great supporters and mentors throughout your professional and educational development. And to give back to the students or to young people and serve as a mentor and provide opportunities for their professional development is really important. And I'm sure that they value that. So that's a great segue into the United States Hispanic Leadership Institute, which we call USHLI or USLI. Can you tell us about how you became interested in that organization and eventually became a board member?
Well,
and now chair.
Yes. Well, the initial credit really goes to my wife Maria Teresa. She had invited Dr. Andrade to come to Lane Community College to deliver a keynote there, and I met him there. And that's kind of an interesting story because at the end of his keynote, he indicated he'd been traveling and he hadn't caught up in his telenovela. And I think it was Distilando Amor. And one of the characters had just found out that, you know, the child, the parent was at issue. It wasn't his. And that was like a really big deal. And so I just, you know, casually gave him an update. And then so we kicked it off from there. And it was an incredible partnership really, you know, gave us a window to an approach that was so transformative for young students that my wife and I decided that we were going to get as many students as we could to USHLI so that they could transform, that they could utilize that education to become the best version of themselves that they were designed to be.
That's great. And you know, USHLI has been really impactful. It's a national organization that I think is the biggest leadership conference for Latino, Latina collegiates throughout the country. I mean, almost every state is represented at that conference, and it's every year in Chicago. And I always try to attend and support Dr. Andrade, which is one of home folk. He's family. He's from my small town of Brownwood, Texas. In fact, his brother was my father's classmate. And so it's always good to support him and the organization. So now let's talk a little bit about the topic that you really want to examine, the demographics and the social dynamics that have really created an era of social tension in the United States. And I'm curious about what your perspective is on that. Attorney Harrelson, I'm quite disturbed as a citizen of this country, as a person who believes that this country has gotten better and better every decade. And for us to be in an era where is this pushback to push us back into a time that was not good for everyone, that it is really disheartening in some kind of way for many of us, because we don't want to believe that our neighbors, our friends, our colleagues have ideas about where certain people should be and where other people should be in our society.
Well, you know, this is really such an important discussion because we're facing issues and tensions that are not going to go away. If we look back, if I look back at my youth, I had no awareness that a day was coming where the majority would change in the country. And it wasn't really until perhaps the 1990s that you had a strong sense, perhaps a national awareness, that demographic conversion was coming. Now, when it's distal, it's like it's not something that you worry so much about. But when it feels like it's about to come upon us, it can leave some feeling a great sense of fear that they may lose something. They may lose power. They may lose some important aspect of themselves because of that change. And that, if we think about that kind of on a timeline and imagine a spiral of tension that grows and grows and grows beyond the conversion, right? If left alone, you know, that's the risk that we run. Complacency will hurt us. Complacency will cost lives. And complacency will keep us from becoming the best society that we could possibly be. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't mean to sound trite with that, but the reality of it is this. We are in a place where we have become so accustomed to vitriol, to hate speech, to negativity, to attacking and criticizing, so reactive that it seems like there isn't a lot of room to talk about love. Mm. Imagine a politician today talking about love, needing to be front and center, probably get eaten alive. We see in politics, frankly, competitions to see who can be the most vitriolic. The difficulty is that there's some truisms in front of us in terms of what it takes to produce justice. Justice isn't just something in the criminal justice system. It's something that we think about social justice, We think about the Pledge of Allegiance that speaks to justice for all, okay? When we talk about that term, there's philosophers that have spent a lot of time in written books about what that means. It's a dynamic term, but there's two critical pieces that you need in order to have justice. The first is you must have a community. And by community, you have that means you've got people that have a common thread together. The second aspect of justice is you must have love. Now, if you take either of those away, you will not have justice. Now, if we think about this in the context of any kind of relationship that we have, whether it's a personal relationship, whether it's a family relationship, whether it's our community relationship, in all of our systems, if we are stagnant and don't invest in that relationship, the relationship will die. It will suffer. Mm-hmm. That's just a given truism of humanity. Mm-hmm. And so when it comes to the question of how we engage with each other, when we're going into this, you know, tension point, the question for us is, how are we going to be proactive and center ourselves with love in order to achieve justice? Because if we marginalize love, and we can talk about love in terms of caring and so forth, but it's important to think about it in the purest form, not in the form of infatuation, not in the form of, you know, wanting people to like us, but to think about the unconditional love that a parent might feel for their child. And this is an important theme because it touches on every one of our systems, and in particular, education. Education comes to the forefront because when we talk about love, that is what education should be built upon. In other words, as a parent, we want our child to have an education, not just so they can check a box, not so that they can brag about it, but so that they can develop their thinking and their knowledge and their wisdom to be able to experience the richest life they possibly can. And so with that gift, if that's really what we're striving for, then we need to be thinking about the environments that we create for that to prosper.
Man, I love this conversation, and you are truly a philosopher. my daddy would have loved talking to you. You know, you're talking about love and light, basically. Love and light in everything that we do in order to create a society that embraces all, that wants all to have and prosper and live in light and love, if you will. My question to you is, you know, when you talk about justice, that you have to have community and you have to have love, and if either of them are not present, then you can't have justice. My question to you is, those of us who embrace that philosophy, what can we do to dismantle this type of society which creates the tension that we have in this era? What are the steps? What do we need to do in order to just make this society better?
Well, we have to take action. You know, again, it's sort of the dynamic, it serves as the best example, a relationship that is very important to us. In order to sustain that relationship, we actually have to take action. There are things that we have to do. It's no different than cultivating a garden. Anything that is living, that we want to flourish, there is action. If we take inaction or if we attack and destroy, then we're not going to reap the harvest that we seek to reap. And, you know, we've become so conditioned with all of this that I want to illustrate with an example that captures the essence of this, perhaps. To think about this, if you could reflect back on a time in your life, and just to kind of privately think about in your mind, a time in your life where you felt the safest and the most loved, okay? And I want you to picture that in that moment in your life where it was an environment where you just felt absolutely, you know, loved. Now, I want you to think about another environment, and that is the environment where in your life you felt homesick. And I'm not talking about just a little homesick. I'm talking about homesick where we cried and it really, really hurt. Okay. Now, the reason I wanted you to think about those two is because I want to invite all of us to be thinking about the environments that we operate in and ask, how would you have performed in the environment where you were homesick? And how would you perform in that environment where you felt loved? Now, how many of us are in environments where the majority of our energy goes into survival and looking out for dangers, versus being in an environment where we don't have to worry about that? And so that becomes a critical aspect of the environments that we are operating in and how we can take actions to become the best version of ourselves. You know, that's a gift to society for us to reach those potentials. Unfortunately, these elements of fear wind up getting in the way of, you know, a lot of that effort. And as I mentioned before, complacency is perhaps one of the biggest traps.
You know, in putting it in that perspective, that means all of us, each and every one of us, have a role in bringing in love and community and shaping community and creating environments that are really conducive to justice, as you stated. No matter what industry, what sector you work in, you have a responsibility to make an impact and empower your communities. And the way you do that is through action. Like you said, your individual action and then influencing the collective action.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, you remind me of, again, some of the challenges, the things that are set into us, like implicit bias, the things that we've been conditioned to default to, okay? And the example that I would offer is, think about the criminal justice system. And to what extent has humanity really been conditioned to view the criminal justice system as a system that should inflict punishment in the spirit of moral outrage, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and how that's reinforced time and time again. Now, one can understand that reaction, you know, especially in the context of, you know, somebody, you know, hurts you or someone that you love, and you know, there's a sense of I want justice. But that's a different objective than the approaches that we see, for instance, with treatment courts across the country. The treatment courts, we have a response to individuals who are truly high risk, high need, meaning that they've got a moderate to severe substance use disorder. If we were to simply react with the spirit, the goal of retribution, then we're not doing anything to address the causation. And those justice systems are now really not developing as an island, but rather developing as an evolution of the existing justice system, where we are making more informed decisions at each critical decision point. Now, to what extent do we take a similar approach in seeking to see people and the richness that they may bring, or the needs that they may have that we can be responsive to? Now, that's not going to solve every problem in the world, but it is a very different approach. And even though we understand it, to what extent do we default back into the retribution model? So we have to practice those, I think.
What kind of language do you use to define that other type of justice system?
I would describe that and this is just, you know, short of me giving it the long explanation that I did, really it is a critical, informed thinking justice system. On the front end of so many of these things, it boils down to having the ability to think about how we think and to be able to make decisions that are not reactionary, but that are very complex, informed, and in many cases, have the advantage of having more than one level of expertise involved in that process.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about the justice system and you talk about this era of social tension and how fear and different types of biases are informing the way people act, interact, or don't interact with each other, how do you think people who are on the side of love and community, how through their actions, how should they act, interact, or not interact with the opposing forces, right? Because we're trying to build community, right? An American community. How does action relate to those that are opposed to building a multiracial, multicultural community?
Right. Well, in the final analysis, our success will be defined by our capacity to communicate. Mm-hmm. So if we're facing challenging situations, we have to ask ourselves, what is the best avenue to communicate? One of the challenges that we face is the practice of flattening each other, or labeling each other in a particular way. I'm going to dismiss John because he's a prosecutor. I'm going to dismiss John because he's Mexican. I'm going to dismiss John, and the list goes on. I think we see that I'm going to dismiss someone because they're you know, a doctor, because they're a politician, because they're, you know, whatever that might be. And in that, we miss the step of the seeing the complexity of who that person is. So then the question is, if we just become complacent and we fall into those practices, what have we lost and what can we gain? And so again, that goes to the communication piece. Simple fact and point. We can have a linear conversation that follows the topics that we're talking about. And at the same time, we can see each other and see the complexities of who we are. You know, I recall seeing your parents at the USHLI conference. And I recall the connection, the strong connection they had with Dr. Andrade. I witnessed that. And, you know, when it comes to thinking about those people that we care the most about in our lives, you know, those are areas that as human beings, I would imagine, they're important footholds for us to understand dynamic and to perhaps open up communications. Because one of the risks that you might run is, oh, that guy's talking about love. That's just, you know, and then dismiss. But do we talk about it in sort of an esoteric, abstract way? Or do we talk about it in the context that I've shared with you? The simple example of what it feels like to be super homesick. Everybody can relate to that, whether they want to admit it or not. And then number two, what it feels like to be in that place. And I think to myself, when I was a little boy, we were in Monterrey, Nuevo León. The house was, you know, really just, it was a two-bedroom apartment type of a house with many of us in there. And I didn't have any sense that we were lacking anything. Every single day, my aunts and uncles would come by, and some of them would bring panes and tortillas and different things. And it was just a constant warm, like waves of the ocean coming, and just, you know, a feeling of absolute love and safety and just, you know, support. And all of us have experienced some aspect of that, at least in the course of our lives, to be able to say, okay, well, isn't this what we want for humanity? And surely, you know, I think Dr. Martin Luther King talked about stepping back and finding the common denominator. And if love can't be the common denominator, then I think we're going to be in a lot of trouble.
love has to win over everything, and love has to be the common denominator. So, Attorney Harrelson, we are now in our college strategies portion of our interview. I am a big advocate for higher education. And I want to know, you know, you went to college for undergrad, you went to law school. What strategy you would have for students who are interested in pursuing that college education or who are already currently in college? But first, could you please give us the colleges you attended? What were your majors and your degrees? And then what is that strategy you would provide for college success?
You bet. I went to Big Bend Community College in Moses Lake, Washington, where I got an Associate of Arts degree and I was playing basketball. I went from Big Bend Community College to Central Washington University in Ellensburg, Washington. And then I got a bachelor's degree in philosophy. And then from there, I went to University of Oregon, go Ducks. I got a Juris Doctorate degree at the University of Oregon. And I am a licensed attorney in Oregon and the state of Washington. So with regards to what I've learned that I would say I would wish that I had this and what strategies I might suggest, it's really a three-point strategy. The first is understanding that the biggest myth that is told about school and success is that people made it on their own. They made it by themselves. That is the biggest myth, and it hurts many people. Because the truth is, nobody makes it on their own. And if you're being encouraged to believe that lie, then you put yourself at a disadvantage. It's important for us to utilize the support in those networks to create an environment where we're going to be able to perform at our highest level. So how do we do that if we don't have the network? Well, we need to build that network. And that's the second point of the strategy, and that is ask questions. You'd be surprised how many people you could reach out to that you may connect with, either because of your belief system, because of your race, your ethnicity, your gender, any number of variables that make us unique, to reach out to those individuals and to say, I'd like to have you as a mentor. Will you meet with me? The overwhelming majority of the people are going to say yes, and they will. It's interesting, though, how few people take advantage of that. And the great thing about it is it doesn't cost anything. Now, as we build that network and gain a better understanding from those who have, already traveled the road and can give us great insights for success, we can strategize in order to create the environment where we're going to thrive. If we choose an environment that is going to bring challenges to us in our success, we should go in eyes wide open. If we choose that environment that is going to be ideal, the best way for us to find that out is by asking the questions. Because again, it all boils down to the issue of being in a place where your energy is focused on growing, on learning. Your energy is not focused on trying to survive, to fend off threats, manage marginalization and oppression. That is not where your energy should be going. I often think to myself, for those who have had great successes, despite having to spend so much time and energy thinking about survival, worrying about threats that may be there, having to manage oppression, having been viewed perhaps as invisible. Think about how historically women are so marginalized. There's a book that I just recently read called Invisible Women that laid out I think some really important statistics and reality checks for us with regards to, how we have, and in many cases, not even aware of the degree to which that marginalization takes place. But all of that to make the point that part of the strategy has to be to pick the playing field where you will perform the best. Your education is preparing you to provide something that the whole world will benefit from. So it's in everyone's interest for you to become that best version of yourself and to be strategic about it.
Love this advice. Three pieces of advice. There is a myth that's a myth that you are not making it on your own. Everybody needs support and networks. Second, make sure you build your network, and you do that by reaching out to others. And third, create a professional environment where you can thrive. I've never heard that one before. A lot of times people of color think that, we go into these positions and we get in them and we're just surviving, like you said. We're fighting oppression, we're doing this, instead of really choosing environments where we can really prosper and thrive. That's a great piece of advice, and so that you can be strategic, to your point, about where you go and where you serve. Because the most important thing in life is serving others. So you want to spend most of your time living to your fullest potential in serving others versus fighting others. I really, really like that piece of advice. Secondary, I do want to ask you about attending community college. We know that the majority of African Americans and Latinos attend community colleges. And so I'm curious about your experience. I know this is an add-on, but what would you say to young people who are pursuing community college as their first option? Because a lot of people look down on community colleges when they're really the first place that many of us go for our education.
This question really dovetails very nicely into my third point. And that is that if you're choosing an environment where you're really going to thrive, and the reason for that is because that community college offers that healthy dynamic. It's not toxic for you. Then that can be an absolutely great way to go. For many members of our community, there's an expectation that you're going to be close to home or live at home. And so that may be the best avenue to have that entry point, to be able to, feel safe. Those same elements come up with respect to, that entry point. And it's such a critical piece, because the rest of it is, to some degree, I have to say that, and I'm not taking anything away from perhaps starting out at an Ivy League school. I think that looks great on a resume. But at the end of the day, that alone doesn't mean that you're going to be safe.
Well, thank you so much, Attorney Harrelson. I have thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with you.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Terry Ungully, theme song, NADWORKS, digital support, and of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.